Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us. And thank you, by the way, for all of the good pictures on Twitter of you guys getting your t-shirts. We are really good at shipping, turns out, because those t-shirts went out fast.
that's actually pretty funny.
Maybe not Kai and I specifically. But
oh, man. No, no.
The organization.
In fact, had nothing to do with this. All right, so we're going to do a little, what are we going to do? I think we're going to do policy. This week is what it is. It's policy on like a zillion different levels. We're going to talk about something called the Green New Deal. And my guess is, being the informed news consumers that y'all are, you have heard of it by now and you know vaguely what it is. But we're gonna take it apart and really sort of discuss what it is and why it matters. It is, in its most present circumstance, a resolution put forth by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC as she's known, and Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, Senator Markey as he's known. We're gonna tell you what it is and why it matters.
Is that going to go on the whole show?
I don't know. Why it matters most fundamentally right now is that Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the United States Senate, has said he's going to put this thing to a vote. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yes.
There's some history involved with this thing and the actual New Deal from 80-ish years ago now, President Roosevelt, during the Depression. So we're going to talk about all that stuff.
Yeah, and sort of the attempt to frame the Green New Deal as, in the legacy of the original New Deal, a huge public investment, I think primarily, mm-hmm. right? So that it's policy, it's government programs, it's regulation, it's financial overhaul, and it is ultimately about fixing the economy. And then there's a huge part of that that includes reshaping the economy toward fairness and equality and justice, which is really interesting. And of course, the mm-hmm. legacy of the New Deal now is coming back into focus as people talk about, you know, the ways that it fundamentally did change our economy yeah. by guaranteeing pensions and creating social safety nets that had never existed before, increasing the quality of life of a lot of poor Americans, yeah. not to mention, you know, roads and bridges and dams.
I mean, look around. A lot of the infrastructure in this country right now is New Deal stuff and would not be here without it. Anyway, so what we're going to do is we're going to talk to Amy Westervelt. She's been an environmental reporter for like 20-something years. She's contributed to The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal as well. She does her own podcast. It's called Drilled, which is the story of the creation of climate change denial, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon in this day and age of the climate getting hotter. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good. How are you? Hi, guys.
I'm good. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thank you.
We're going to tackle this really easy topic in, you know, 11 minutes flat. We got this. We got this.
I know. My head is spinning like, okay, what 10 things can we talk about? Yeah.
We'll try. We'll do our best. Do you want to give us the kind of recent history of the idea of the Green New Deal? It seems like there are probably several people who are grinding their teeth right now watching Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez get all the credit.
Yeah. So, one thing I would say is that it's kind of interesting how much it does include things like job and, you know, wealth gaps and social justice. And, you know, it's been criticized for that, for kind of trying to take on too many things at once in the guise of climate. But a lot of people for a long time in the climate movement have been talking about how actually that's what needs to happen, that climate isn't this whole separate thing over there to be dealt with in the future, that it is this thing that touches on every aspect of the economy, every aspect of, you know, American life, and that to really get at it requires, you know, a whole package of legislation that would get into all of these different things from infrastructure to housing and all of the, you know, kind of traditional energy climate stuff too. So I feel like that's been going on for a while. I do think that I don't know if people are grinding their teeth or not. I think it might actually there's a significant number of people who I think are excited about having someone who has a lot of social capital kind of bringing this forward.
Yep, definitely.
So we'll get to the politics of this thing in a minute, but could you lay out for us what the Green New Deal is supposed to do? Because there are very distinct aims, right?
Yeah, I mean, there kind of are and aren't. So it's a non-binding resolution to start with. So this whole idea of the vote is, I think, has been kind of hyped up a lot because what does it really mean to vote yes or no on a non-binding resolution? But it does set out a few key things, one of which is to aim in 10 years to get the U.S. 100% off of carbon-based fuels, which is pretty ambitious. Yeah. It also aims to overhaul the infrastructure, which includes not only, you know, the grid, which will need to be updated to make all this new renewable energy work, but also, you know, failing buildings, all of the water pipes that we've been hearing about forever. You know, it's going to really be infrastructure week this time. and then there's a jobs guarantee, and that has been like a big focal point of both like criticism and praise, I think, that you know, in order to – if you're going to suggest something that really overhauls the economy and touches every part of it, that you have to kind of promise people jobs and decent wages and healthcare guarantees. It also gets into things like fixing family leave policy, looking at, you know, ensuring that indigenous –
splash of universal basic income.
Yes, there is. There's UBI is in there. Yep. I feel like Medicaid for all is making a slight, you know, appearance. It is kind of, you know, broaching the subject of all of these things together. But, you know, it doesn't actually specify any specific legislation. It's really kind of like an organizing principle. And, you know, the idea would be that I do feel like another specific thing it mentions is the formation of a committee that would come up with specific legislation under this. But Pelosi kind of refused to form that committee already. So there's already a little bit of Democrat infighting over what this would mean.
So just like the original New Deal, right, there's a social justice component. In this case, it's lower income and people of color as opposed to way back when it was the elderly and the poor, right?
Right.
There's the jobs guarantee. And then there's literally the infrastructure bit, which is analogous to, you know, the WPA and Civilian Conservation Corps and all that stuff from the 1930s.
Yeah. Yeah, there is.
So it rhymes, as it were.
There is also a big focus on indigenous people as well, and especially around land rights and giving indigenous people more of a voice around some of the energy package parts of the deal. So that would be a big change, too. I mean, right now, a lot of, you know, Standing Rock is the most obvious example, but there have been a lot of issues around pipelines on Native lands, and they seem to be really calling that out in the Green New Deal proposal, too.
Why is that, do you think, this idea of economic justice and a fairer economy? You know, help us, let's like explore this together, why these two things are so tied together and why, you know, it makes sense that ensuring economic fairness and repositioning our government and into a caretaking role, that was a big part of the New Deal. But draws that sort of bright line about how we get from that concept to climate change.
Yeah. Well, one thing is that climate change is already impacting and will definitely impact people of color and low-income people more. So there's an argument to be made that, you know, as we're dealing with that issue, we have to put a special focus on those communities. They also haven't benefited from any of the things that have helped to create climate change, I would say. You know, a big part of why we haven't acted in the last 30 years is that fossil fuel companies have had kind of a stranglehold on energy policy and environmental policy in this country. And while lots of, you know, shareholders have benefited from that, the general public in many ways has not, and particularly people of color and low-income people. So you kind of have this double whammy of, you know, they haven't really benefited and they've been impacted more. On the other end of the spectrum, I think, you know, I think there are some criticisms that are valid around, you know, if you try to tackle everything at once, does it make it hard to get any one thing done? You know, in our current political system, yes. It kind of remains to be seen how much people can really push through any actual policy or legislation around these ideas.
Why do you think it seems to have caught on now?
You know, I was reading this poll from, I believe, Gallup about the kind of shifting ideas around socialism. And it's really interesting because I feel like, you know, A, I do think that that word has kind of been used to label anything that is of anything that kind of helps the public, you know, it gets thrown around a lot for things that used to just be sort of like the job of government. But I think that, you know, we have had stagnant wages for four decades. There has been a growing income inequality in the U.S. And I was just listening to some people talking on the news this morning about, you know, perhaps there is this ideological shift happening in the Democratic Party along the lines of what was happening in the late 70s when Reaganomics kind of took hold that, you know, I think a lot of the millennial generation in particular are seeing, you know, none of these things actually came true for us. Nothing trickled down. and there's a sense of wanting to push for something new. There's also, I think, too, like actually quite a bit of crossover between the sort of, you know, Trump populist ideas and a lot of these like democratic socialist ideas. You know, it's not actually unpopular in, you know, quote unquote real America to talk about job guarantees, you know? So I think that's part of it, too.
Well, let's talk. We've had a lot of conversation now about the Green New Deal without talking about climate and climate change science.
I know. Yeah, it does that.
Which,
which
shows you exactly, like, right, how tricky it really is. You know, you have this podcast. You talk about the creation of climate denial as sort of a political force.
Yeah.
How much more complicated does that make the conversation? The fact that not everybody is even on the same page.
Yeah, extremely. It's so hard. And I honestly think that after having, I mean, I've spent the last 2 years deeply immersed in like internal memos of oil companies and like, you know, unraveling the sort of tangled web of think tanks and front groups and all of these you know, news sites and, you know, energy blogs and things like that that have been created really just in the purpose of furthering climate denial. And it's a real problem. it's very well funded. It's very widespread. And I don't think that you're going to be able to do anything on climate, and certainly not at the level that needs to happen to deliver the kind of emissions reductions that all global scientists are saying we need without getting that money and that influence out of the process. Because you're dealing with a whole separate universe of facts, in air quotes, facts, you know, and it's been really effective. I mean, it's been so effective that oil companies now are having like, you know, are being criticized by climate deniers for like saying too much about how climate change is happening, you know?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They're huh. Yeah. It's an appealing story, you know, like no, like given the choice between, you know, catastrophic climate change that is going to, you know, kill off entire communities and give your kids and grandkids a much lower quality of life. And, oh, it's just a hoax cooked up by some people, you know, scientists who want to make money. It like I can see the appeal.
Do you think, Amy, that what's going on now with the traction it does seem to be getting is a generational thing? I mean, Ed Markey, as he's known, Ed Markey, is no spring chicken, right? But AOC has a whole legion of younger, more progressive followers who are literally demanding action on this.
Yeah, I do think so. I think the younger generation is much less susceptible to the climate denial narrative. You know, all the data on that shows that it's really older, mostly white conservative men who have really bought into that. And that is not what the Democratic Party looks like. So you have a lot more people who have kind of grown up around the idea that this is something that's happening. This is something that needs to be acted upon. You're seeing these worldwide protests from young, I mean, even much younger than AOC, the like teen protests all throughout Europe and the UK. You know, and you're starting to see it in the U.S. too, that there is this real push. And that's an interesting thing around the Green New Deal too, is that it kind of, I don't want to say it doesn't matter what happens with the vote because, you know, sure, you know, it'll give us some indication of where people are standing and where the political divides will lie and all of that. But irrespective of that, it's an issue for the 2020 campaign in a way that it has not been in decades. Every candidate, especially on the Democrat side, has to have a stance on climate change, is being pushed to, you know, have some kind of policy take on it, and really early on, too. So I don't think that's going away no matter what. And I do think that part of it is the youth. And, you know, millennials are becoming the largest voting bloc, and they care about this issue. They have for a while. So, I think that definitely there's a generational shift there.
Hmm. So what comes next? I mean, it does seem like I heard another podcast talk about it as the Overton window, just like pushing the conversation yeah. forward, which is really, you know, awareness matters. And the yeah. like you said, it's now part of the 2020 campaign. It seems unlikely that something this sweeping will happen anytime soon, but what do you think the interim steps start to look like?
I think you're gonna start to see people introduce actual policy. And there's going to be a little bit of this actually, yeah, not only just opening the conversation, but also pushing the Democrats further to the left. There's been some talk about, you know, well, this makes it a lot harder for a Democrat candidate to come out with something that is extremely moderate on climate. So even if it's not something that's as, you know, extreme to the left as the Green New Deal, it's going to be really hard to have like a carbon tax that has a too low price on carbon, for example, you know, as your solution. So it'll be interesting. Mm. I think like we're going to start to see the Democrat candidates in particular, the 2020 candidates coming out with specifics. And I think that Pelosi's going to have to get, you know, she's going to have to be pushed to have a stance, too. She's so far, like, her stance has been basically that the Green New Deal is too much, but there hasn't been anything that's come forth as a replacement for that. She has formed this committee now. It'll be interesting to see what they come out with, what kind of proposals are brought forth.
Okay, so here you go. You ready? I'm going to ask this question, and we're going to see how you respond. Ready?
Yes.
So we're going to decarbonize the American economy in 10 years. We're going to give everybody who wants a job. And we're going to take care of the poor, the weak, the injured, people of color, indigenous people, and everybody else. How are you going to pay for that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's the big question, right? And the answer is like public spending, which, of course, is wildly popular with Republicans. So, yeah. But the sort of the answer to that usually is that, well, if we do nothing or we have a batch of kind of moderate policies that don't really get at the problem, we're going to have massive costs due to inaction as well. Mm-hmm. And you know what? One way to pay for it could be to stop subsidizing fossil fuels. That's mm-hmm. a giant pot of money that could go towards decarbonization.
Well, and massive spending has worked before,
yes,
right? Like
true.
The New Deal just mm-hmm. has one example of how spending money can sometimes create money.
Yeah, and there is a kind of popular narrative from fossil fuel companies and many conservative politicians is that climate change is a global problem and that it requires a global solution and that we can't basically like, you know, put the U.S. on the hook so much that we bear an unfair burden of solving that problem. But when you look at who is actually producing the world's oil and gas, the data right now shows that by 2030, 60% of growth in oil and gas extraction will be from U.S. companies. So it's really hard to look at that and look at how the rest of the world is like trying to sign on to the Paris Agreement and pushing for, you know, emissions reductions and all of that and not see the U.S. as a really big part of the problem that needs to get things together. mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then kind of finally, not for nothing, the climate is changing. Is it now, are we now to the point, like, is it possible that the biggest driver of this conversation in the next couple of years will be the actual incontrovertible increased severity of the weather?
Yes. I this is like the thing I've been saying the most lately is that, you know, the most effective communications tool climate activists have is natural disasters. I mean, it's really hard to look at the intensity of storms and wildfires and also the increased migration. Like, you know, we talk about immigration and refugees and all this stuff. And climate is a huge part of that, too. So, I think it gets harder and harder to pretend it's not happening when every week there's a news story about some kind of extreme weather thing. I do feel like that's part of it, too, that we're seeing, you know, it's not just this future abstract thing anymore. We're seeing it constantly and we're experiencing it. Like, you know, there was that story, I think, yesterday from the LA Times about the big one in terms of storms for Southern California, that there could be this like massive storm coming that lasts for weeks and, you know, requires a million people to evacuate. And I mean, it's really, it's
that.
Becoming kind of apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Go find that story. It's scary. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Amy, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Sure. I'll leave you on that cheery note.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I know. I know.
Did you see? We were just sort of stunned into horrified silence right there. Like, oh, okay. All right. Thanks, Amy.
All
right. That was super.
Take it easy.
Amy Westervelt.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming on.
Well, there you go, right? I mean, you know.
It's... Ironically, that's a great line, by the way, that the best talking point they have is natural disasters, okay. Even though, ironically, as we were chatting with Amy in the pre-show, she was saying she lives up near Lake Tahoe, which has been completely snowed under, and was saying that it's really only like today and yesterday that she was even able to get out and come to the studio, just to go ahead and drive that point home.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, this whole thing, and we're going to see what happens with the vote on the Green New Deal and AOC's resolution and all that stuff. But the problem is that this, as with so much in our political debate, has gotten caught up in the deep cynicism of American politics today, right?
Yep.
And there's no good faith discussion to be had. And when you've got members of the Senate going on the Senate floor saying, I've got a snowball in my hand. It's snowing in Washington. How can there be global warming?
It's not global warming. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, I this may surprise you, but I'm going to take the hopeful tack.
Go ahead.
Which is that, okay, the first, I read this in our prep notes, that the first use of the term Green New Deal may trace to 2007 in a column by the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, when the weather wasn't that bad. I mean, I really actually do think that for a growing number of Americans— like, the political gridlock, even the Democratic infighting right now, is such a huge barrier to getting anything done. But I think it's up to 78% of Americans were like, yeah, the weather's way worse than it used to be. This seems really real.
Yeah.
And that at some point, you know, you could argue about whether that point is, like, way too late.
Yep.
But at some point, the weather itself is going to make this, like, the controversy a non-issue. And then the question is just going to be, like, can we get out of our own way and save our own lives?
No.
Good times.
No.
Good times.
Can't.
Oh my God, this guy.
Sorry.
Are you there?
All right,
do you have the dark place sting?
Right.
You ready to go?
I don't even think they have it. Oh, there we go. There we go.
Is.
That was almost too easy. You guys are like a beat late. Anyway, send us your thoughts about climate change or what you just heard or me being so gloomy all the time. Whatever. Whatever you like. Make me smart at marketplace.org. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, business movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, we're back. We're back. I don't know what that was. I got one this time. I got a little news item to talk about, and I noticed, Ms.
Thank
Wood,
God.
Here in our shared Google Doc rundown, you have left me bereft of a companionship. I'm just saying.
I am bereft, so help me out here. Help me out. I mean, I'll think of something while you're talking, but...
Well, that's what I usually do. All right, so... So look, so here's the deal. And this actually goes on to the conversation that we were having about the Green New Deal. You might have heard that this morning, it's Tuesday, as we tape this, Bernie Sanders, 77-year-old senator from Vermont, has said, yes, indeed, I want to be your president again, which is interesting on a whole lot of levels, just speaking specifically Green New Deal-wise, and what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents in the Democratic Party, of which, parenthetically, Bernie Sanders is not a member, close parentheses. He has dragged that party to the left, and I think it's really, really interesting. The problem, of course, for the Democrats in 2020, they have many problems, one of which is that there are so many of them who are going to run. The other one is money, 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 money. And my little item this morning is a tweet from Dave Weigel of the Washington Post, crack political reporter there. Here's what he says. Sanders' campaign says it's raised $1 million since its launch 3.5 hours ago. That was this morning. Donations in from all 50 states. And I saw a later tweet from Weigel that said, Sanders' campaign staff says, yeah, and California's not even awake yet. So look out, man. Let's remember that Bernie Sanders raised a gazillion dollars with an average donation of, I think it was $27 a person in 2016. Yeah. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens because a lot of people are like, oh, God, Bernie, go away. And everybody's like, oh, Kamala and Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren. And here's Bernie showing, I got the money. Show me the money.
The money really matters. Well, and not for nothing. But a Green New Deal was also part of his 2016 campaign. Yeah. And that's partly why I say that there are a lot of people gritting their teeth because, you know, Jill Stein had a Green New Deal, heaven help us.
From the Green Party.
From the Green Party, right. Which is not a huge shocker. But it, absolutely, like to that point about the Overton window, unquestionably, that campaign, I think, kicked us all. You know what
you
it
bet.
Was? I think it was still processing.
Wesley Morris's
since
podcast.
We talked to Wesley Morris, his podcast.
Should we tell people what the Overton window is?
Probably. Yep. The Overton window, but I'm going to duck, duck, go it real quick so I get it exactly right. It's the idea that there are, I'm going to just read from Wikipedia, actually, that's easier. A range of ideas tolerated in public discourse. So otherwise known as the window of discourse. So like that there are certain things that were a third rail that you just didn't talk about, a Green New Deal, or you didn't talk about socialism. You didn't talk about economic redistribution, for example, until arguably the Sanders campaign made it okay and moved that window to the left a little bit and made certain conversations suddenly not so ridiculous to have. And then, of course, the Trump presidency has created a whole other set of Overton windows and things that it is apparently okay to say in public. That's what that political – it's a political theory at its heart, too.
Yes.
And it is super interesting.
So, anyway, so that's my thing. That's my thing, Bernie Sanders.
I mean, honestly, I just spent the whole weekend reading the late Sunday night report by British lawmakers that referred to Facebook as digital gangsters.
Oh, yeah. How about that,
Mark Zuckerberg in particular.
Yeah.
A digital
doesn't
gangster.
He does not care. I know he says he cares. I know Sheryl Sandberg says she cares. They don't care because they don't have to care. What's the penalty, right? What's the cost? Zero cost.
There is the only thing, one possible argument is I have a story coming out tomorrow on Marketplace Tech, so Wednesday the 20th, about Amazon's ad ambitions and how fast Amazon is coming up behind them. So the only thing that will help us here is Facebook not making so much money. And it turns out that Amazon has this like really crazy killer argument, which is, hey, when you're actually shopping for stuff, what if we showed you ads for stuff you want? As opposed to like when you're looking at baby pictures from your extended family or finding out who got fat from high school, would you also like to buy this fancy sweater? What? No.
Wow.
That makes no sense to me. But Amazon is like, turns out I know what you bought before. And if I show you a thing that I'm pretty sure you're going to want to buy, you're going to buy it. And advertisers are like, really? Let's talk. Way more. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe there's that. Maybe it won't come from consumers or regulators or anything. But what I do find interesting about lawmakers from Europe attempting to push the Overton window of what it's to do in terms of, regulate a giant public company. What I wonder is if there will be, much like there's going to be a reflexive conservative pushback against an idea that is perceived as socialist, if there will also be a pushback against the idea of regulating these companies the way that Europe wants to. Because is like a dogma around not having as many regulations as Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I wonder what that's going to do to our conversation about regulating these companies.
It's going to bring it to a screeching halt. How's our conversation on regulating these companies doing now, Ms. Wood? Not so good.
You know, it's going to really annoy me if we get to the end of the year and Kai was right all along and his like nihilistic. I just thought you didn't want to come up with any predictions, and now I'm like,
episode 135, and yeah. All right. We got to go do like a mailbox thing. Bye. Oh, my goodness.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different,
I want
maybe
that guy's
related
name.
Thing.
I want this guy's. Who is this guy? I want to give
the
him
slightly
a shout
different,
out.
But maybe related.
The most awesome thing ever. Anyway.
I know.
Yes.
Was it you? Tweet us.
Yes.
Tweet us, person.
Yes, please. Look, so lots of responses on the Oscars and our conversation with Wilson Morris last week from his podcast, All Processing, The New York Times. One of our listeners who wants only to be known as broke college student from Ohio State University, he sent us, or she perhaps, we're going to find out because I haven't heard the tape yet, sent us this voice memo on whether he is going to be watching the Oscars this year.
My coworkers and friend group, mostly aged 21 to 25, will not be watching the award show, as they have become boring, too politically correct, and just another hand-wavy attempt at forced diversity to mask an overarching problem in the entertainment industry. Love the show. Love you guys. Keep it up.
Oh, thanks, man. Can't argue with you, though. Oof. I mean, he's right.
That's
right?
Pretty concise, yeah. Hand-wavy attempt at forced diversity, which is sometimes how it starts to feel. Ugh. Yep. Rand Dixon from Wisconsin agrees. He says he's a blue-collar worker who has no skin in the Oscars game.
Is there any reason I should care what happens at these award shows each year? And also, why do they make such a big splash in the news each time they happen?
Money. Right? Money.
But also, I know, also a super fair question, right? Why do we talk about
it
so much?
It's the entertainment industrial complex, if I could paraphrase Dwight Eisenhower. Man, I'm all history today.
And
holy cow.
It is huge. Yeah. Well, I know, because, you know, once you go down like the New Deal rabbit hole, you really go all the way there.
Goodness. Catherine Brazil Black provides her answer on why she cares. She says the Oscars is still one of the few events we can all collectively watch. And here's what she says. As media and entertainment spreads out further and we get more streaming platforms, more content, more niche entertainment, I think these big annual live entertainment events become a nice shared conversation point. I endorse
there
the spirit
that.
Of that comment.
I mean, we all go to the movies. Like, people, there's a reason that it makes money and it's, you know.
Right, that's true. That's a really
good point.
It
becomes a little self-feeding. But, yes, like, we all go to the movies. And then to the question, actually, this next listener, Jody Pritchard from Minneapolis, I think has an answer to why it's actually okay to have a hand-wavy attempt at forced diversity. And she says the Oscars matter because of movies' cultural significance. And what you see on screen, whether it's on the award show or in the movies— affects what happens off screen. She says that as a lesbian, that's been particularly important for her. So here you go.
Visibility also helps create and sustain allies. Without increased visibility, we would not have marriage equality, employment protections, and the ability of gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, right? I mean, and cultural industries, I suppose, are often on the forefront of pushing those barriers in the rest of society. That's true.
Right.
Sure.
And representation matters. I mean, and that's what I was saying about the Grammys, too, which is that if it was the first time you ever watched the Grammys, you wouldn't be thinking to yourself, like, this is politically correct and they're just trying to, like, make everybody feel good. You'd be thinking, oh, everybody's represented here.
Right.
Young, old, people of color, women, like, every kind of music. And that actually really does, over time, have a profound impact.
Yeah, totally. All right, make me smart question time. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? And we're just going to play this tape.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Wade Young, and I have an answer to the make me smart question.
I could have sworn the lead singer of Toto was saying that Kilimanjaro rises like a leprous above the Serengeti. I thought a leprous was a female leopard. I was wrong. I still sing it that way, though, because it just sounds better. Thanks. I know that I must do what's right.
Oh, man. Let's listen. Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti.
I seek to cure what's deep inside. Yeah, totally. It sounds just like leprous. This is like, can I just say that this is, it's apparently it's Olympus. Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus. A leprous.
Yes.
Above the Serengeti. I got to say, there were like three Michael Jackson songs that I had this problem with. Yep. Like my whole entire life, I thought that Billie Jean, he was saying, Billie Jean is not my brother. He's just a girl. And it was really confusing. Yeah, Billie Jean is not my brother.
That's a whole different.
He's just a girl. And I was, but I just went with it. I just sang right along to it. And then I thought that in Beat It, when he says, show them you're funky.
Oh my God.
This is like borderline E. I thought he was saying, choke the hot monkey. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to move right on past that because, yep.
Yes, we are. Uh-huh. Yep. Send us your thoughts. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Be sure to copy the Federal Trade, Federal Communications
Why
Commission.
Go there? Although we're not it would have passed the nine-year-old window.
Thankfully.
It's just funny.
It would have passed the
nine. The nine-year-old doesn't think
Is that
it's
what you have? You have a nine-year-old window on that kind of stuff?
An E? Then it's not.
Oh, my God.
The question is,
Overton windows and nine-year-old windows.
And apparently it can be on any topic. What is something that you thought you knew? And you later found out you were wrong about, please send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org because as you can see, this often leads to the best moment of the whole show.
It totally does, actually.
That's a really good one.
I like that one.
Plus,
I like that,
that song is a thing now.
And you know what? It's Guts everywhere. To Admit. Guts to Admit from Wade Young.
Yeah, because there's a remake by Weezer.
Is it?
Weezer.
I'm so not hip. I'm so... Oh, God. I ought to just not... Anyway... Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. He says, looking through the glass. Yes, it was. Our theme music composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Oh, by the way, check out the video on our website about them talking about this song and how they go about thinking about how to create it. I thought it was pretty cool. It's on the episode from last week, probably, right?
The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And those are the important things to say because they're the only reason we're on the show.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.